In 1934, the modernist poet Ezra Pound was asked to define poetry, and he wrote in response, "Poetry is news that stays new." There's something about this quote that reminds me of my childhood, when my parents used to get the newspaper every morning, and they'd sit down and read it in a very concentrated way for around half an hour each morning. And then as the days of the week went by, a stack of newspapers would build on the kitchen table until Sunday, when my dad would collect them and throw them in the recycle bin. And the whole process was kind of mysterious to me. I wondered how the newspaper could transform from something that was so valuable to my parents to basically trash. But imagine if one day you sat down to read the newspaper and you read it and you felt this kind of strange enchantment with it, that it was something about the language of the newspaper was beautiful, that this newspaper was somehow different to every other bit of newspaper you had ever read before. And so you take it upstairs to your bedroom and you put it under your bed, and every night before you go to sleep you take it out and you read a few lines from it, and you feel a sublime sense of beauty in the language of the newspaper. The person that we're about to speak to kind of, in a way, had that type of experience.
Yeah, I'm Kenneth Goldsmith. I'm a poet based in New York City. Now, I just received a day's copy of the New York Times on my doorstep on September 1st of 2000. I had nothing to do, so I just looked at the newspaper and I thought, gee, what if I just retype the whole thing? And so I started. And a year and a half later, I was done.
How long every day would you devote to typing up this one edition of the New York Times?
Well, you know, I mean, as much as I could do, sometimes 8 hours a day.
And how many words was it in total?
I have no idea. I never did a word count, but it's about 900 pages long.
Does that include like text inside advertisements?
Wherever there was language in the newspaper, it went into my book. So yeah, if there was a car ad, I'd have to kind of get a magnifying glass out and type out the license plate number.
What was some of the reactions you got to publishing a typed out book of the New York Times' poetry?
I remember sending a copy of it to the New York Times back in 2003 or 2004, something like that. And I think that, you know, it got thrown into the slush pile. They were like, you know, what the fuck is this, right? But then recently, when my last book was reviewed in the New York Times, all they could talk about was my important book called Day, when I had, without the Times' permission, bootlegged the entire edition of the Times. So somehow, you know, a decade later, it was safe to call it a masterpiece, but when it happened, nobody paid any attention to it.
I know what you're probably thinking now. What's changed in the last decade to make a typed-up edition of the New York Times into a masterpiece? Well, actually, Kenneth Goldsmith's work has had a lot to do with it. Let me give you a brief run through his bibliography so you can kind of understand where he's coming from. For example, he's written a 600-page book of phrases that all rhyme with R, a rapist, a robber, a prostitute, a crack user. A thing is nothing but the complex of its character. A 20th century man, the guy has no future. A wilderness whose glance no civilization could endure. And in 1999, he wrote Fidget, which was a transcription of every movement his body made during a 13-hour period.
Back on back of chair, legs touch legs, arms parallel arms of chair, hands grasp bend of arms, legs push back, feet flat on ground, elbow on arm, arms out, cup to mouth, swallow.
In 2002, he wrote Head Citations, which is basically just a massive list of commonly misquoted song lyrics.
Big old Jenny Delightful, big old Jed and the Rhino, big old Aunt Jemima, big old Jed's pet rhino.
And in 2005, he wrote The Weather, which is basically just transcribed weather reports.
As far as today's picture is concerned, we have two things of interest to show you. First of all, this frontal system that's edging down very slowly from the north, bringing colder northerly winds into those northern parts of the country.
And then there was also soliloquy, which Kenny describes himself as...
Every word I spoke for a week from the moment I woke up on a Monday morning to the moment I went to sleep on a Sunday night.
And then there's his most recent book, Seven American Deaths and Disasters, which is radio transcriptions of things like JFK's death, Michael Jackson's death, and 9/11. Still confused? Well, that's probably a good thing. Kenny's writing is supposed to be confusing, or at least challenging. He calls his writing style uncreative writing, and the basic idea is this. We live in a world that's drenched in language. There is language literally everywhere. The role of the writer in this world is not to create new language, but to reimagine the language that's already there.
You know, language is the most, talk is cheap. It's the most plentiful product. And yet nobody had ever bothered to look what was right below their nose.
Goldsmith's poetry polarizes people. Some people think that it's not really poetry because it's not expression, it's just copying. But other people take issue with Goldsmith's writing because it seems to promote plagiarism as creative practice. Goldsmith's notoriety as a plagiarizer has got him involved in some pretty bizarre stories. For example, in 2012, Shia LaBeouf, who is a big movie star in Hollywood, he's been in movies like Transformers and Indiana Jones, he released a movie called HowardContour.com, which he claimed to have written and directed himself. The movie was shown at Cannes Film Festival in 2012 and was followed by an online premiere in December 2013. Now, shortly after the film's online release, people started to notice it had this really strong resemblance to a comic called Justin M. Damiano by graphic novelist Daniel Clowes. Both the movie and the comic followed the life of a world-weary movie critic, and they were really similar to each other, so people started looking closely at the film and the comic for similarities and found that both open with exactly the same monologue, word for word. LaBeouf had just cut and copied Clowes' work and claimed it as his own. There was inevitable outrage, and Shia removed the movie from his website and claimed not to have plagiarized but just to have got lost in the creative process. He also wrote Clowes an apology that he published online. But get this, it turns out that his apology was itself plagiarized from a 4-year-old Yahoo Answers entry about Pablo Picasso. Then it starts to get even weirder. Shia LaBeouf hired a skywriter to etch "I am sorry, Daniel Clowes" across the Los Angeles sky. And if that wasn't enough, he started tweeting apologies that other famous people had been forced to give in public, like when Kanye West had to apologize to Taylor Swift for interrupting her.
It was wrong, and it wasn't a spectacle or just, you know, it's actually someone's emotions, right, you know, that I stepped on, and it was very... It was rude, period, and, you know, I'd like to be able to apologize to her in person.
In other words, Shia LaBeouf wasn't apologizing for plagiarism at all, but sending up everyone's sensitivity to it. He was saying things like, "If I paint a river, should God sue me?" But some of his defenses of plagiarism were really quite thoughtful. In one interview, he wrote, and I quote, "It's not plagiarism in the digital age, it's repurposing. Our notion of genius, a romantic, isolated figure, is fucking outdated. An updated notion of genius would have to center around one's mastery of information." But just when you think that Shia LaBeouf is some sort of media genius, it turns out that this quote was, of course, plagiarized too. This time Shia was plagiarizing the king of plagiarism himself, our man Kenneth Goldsmith. Nowadays, it's not often that avant-garde poetry and Hollywood collide, but Goldsmith was still relatively unimpressed by Shia LaBeouf's antics, not because he plagiarized his work, but because Shia's plagiarism was not original enough. It wasn't interesting. Goldsmith teaches a class at the University of Pennsylvania about how to write uncreatively, that is, how to use plagiarism to your advantage. In this class, the students get marked according to the originality with which they plagiarise. Goldsmith didn't think that LaBeouf had done that, and that's why people were angry with him. Had he been a better plagiariser, a smarter plagiariser, people actually would have admired his work, and they wouldn't have been scornful about it. Goldsmith's point seems to be that, although in the digital age there may not be room for personal expression and creativity, originality is still a really important value. Do you feel like it's an imperative for a writer to be original?
Well, I mean, one is original in, you know, in a way maybe a DJ is original, you know? You know, I mean, the DJ is you know, the DJ with the best samples on their laptop and can put those samples together in the best way is the best DJ. You know, nobody ever expects the DJ to go and, you know, play the drums well or be a kick-ass guitarist.
The idea that a writer should behave like a DJ and simply remix the work of other people might be a hard thing to swallow, considering writing is often associated with personal expression. But Kenneth Goldsmith thinks those attitudes are starting to change, and there is one basic reason.
You know, if the cat was out of the bag. If, you know, the minute you put something on the internet, it became fluid and it became unpredictable and it became destabilized. And that was going to lead the discourse of language and textuality, was that destabilization. Of course, you know, that had been a long time coming in modernist literature to destabilize language. But it was always a boutique endeavor. But it isn't until the digital age that we really finally reach a moment of, I guess I want to call it imperative destabilization, where that is the primary characteristic of the text, is the fluidity of it, and its refusal to stay in one state, you know. So I think, like, in a weird way, like, the digital is the fulfillment of modernism's promise. It's come true. All the things I've been saying for all these years that were sort of, people would take as either jokes or provocations, people are now seeing are actually coming true as the digital world progresses.
You've been listening to The Future Is Now, a podcast
written and produced by Oscar Schwartz and James Payne.
The Future Is Now.